Hello and welcome to Radio Prague International, the external service of Czech Radio. Today's Saturday show is dedicated to an interview with Russian academic Sergei Radchenko, who is a Cold War historian and professor of international relations at Cardiff University. He's currently writing a book on the early 1990s with a focus on Eastern Europe and the political discussions that were underway during that time.
Right, so as the Cold War was coming to an end, the Soviet leadership were looking forward to a creation of what Gorbachev referred to as common European home, some sort of a common security infrastructure for all of Europe. The expectation on the Soviet side was that NATO would become irrelevant and, fall apart, more or less. This was based on the notion that NATO was created in opposition to the Soviet Union. Now that the Soviet Union had mended fences with the West, the idea was that NATO would also fade from the historical stage. This is how Gorbachev was thinking about this in the late 1980s.
Because I came across this argument, actually, when I was reading about, you know, how the Czech Republic or Czechoslovakia back then, where it saw itself, whether to join NATO or whether to actually see both alliances dissolved. So what happened? Why didn't NATO get dissolved?
Well, a historical accident. In fact, I was recently reading some interesting documents from the early 1990s. There was a debate among policymakers in Britain, for example, about NATO in the early 1990s. And the general feeling there was that it was almost an accident that NATO even survived the end of the Cold War. There was actually widespread expectation that something would happen, that NATO, which itself had been suffering from a lack of cohesion internally ever since really the 1960s, when the French pulled out of the military structures, that NATO would somehow transform itself out of existence because it had no longer any role. Of course, the Soviets had this kind of expectation. They wanted to invest themselves in common security structures where they would be at the table. And you have to sort of look at this from the Soviet perspective and understand why they wanted to do that. For them, NATO was an enemy out there. Now the Cold War was over, but they wanted to be at the table. And so the process that seemed most suitable for this purpose from their perspective was the security, was the Conference for Security and Cooperation in Europe, CSCE. That was a part of the Helsinki process, which was launched in the early 1970s. So the Soviets, as co-sponsors of this process, effectively wanted to use that for sorting out the security, European security after the Cold War. Now, as for Czechoslovakia, we know that even after 1989, briefly at least, the Czechoslovak leadership actually supported this kind of views on the part of the Soviet Union. And Havel himself, in fact, advocated this, some sort of all-inclusive security structures for Europe. Only briefly, he had traveled to the United States, made even a speech in Congress where he aired some of those ideas. But very quickly, he backpedaled from those ideas. And by the early 1990s already, we have Czechoslovakia, in fact, after the peaceful divorce, Czech Republic, arguing for Prague's inclusion in NATO, in Western security structures, at really the expense of Russia.
I know you're not focused on Czechoslovakia, but did you perhaps come across during your research over any talks, I don't know, maybe between Havel and American representatives, etc., to explain why this position shifted?
It's not particularly clear. You know, I have been wondering about this. I have been wondering because, generally speaking, if you look at Eastern Europe, Central and Eastern Europe, not just the Czech Republic, but also Poland, for example, how the Polish were thinking about the problem, how the Hungarians were thinking, the Balts were thinking about the problem. You see two distinct themes here. On the one hand, there is the fear of the Soviet Union, fear of Russia that is conditioned historically, and for good reason. Look, the Czechs, for example, had every reason to suspect the Russians. It wasn't like in 1968 the Russian or the Soviets did not invade Prague. Of course, you know, this kind of memories linger and influence current perceptions and policy making. So that was certainly a concern for the Polish as well. They could think back to indeed the division of Poland prior to the Second World War and the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, or later the imposition of communism. They could think about 1956, where it came very close to Soviet intervention in Poland, or indeed to the martial law of the 1980s, and they could suspect with good reason any kind of good intention. You know, if Gorbachev was saying, okay, yeah, we'll have peace and zone of security and cooperation from Vancouver to Vladivostok or whatever, you know, the Poles could have a good reason for saying, we don't believe that. We have very, very bad experience. The Czechs, likewise, the Hungarians, 1956 comes to mind here immediately. So they had their security concerns. And this was one of the reasons they were so desperate to be included in Western security structures, because that gave them guarantees against perceived threat from the East. So that's one part of that. The other part of that, of the reasoning in Central and Eastern Europe, has to do with status, prestige, identity fundamentally. Who do you want to belong to? I mean, for the Czechs, this was a no-brainer. They wanted to be a part of the West. It was a question of identity, question of belonging. And to a certain extent, this was also the true for the rest of Central and Eastern Europe. Now, for especially for Havel, this was a key issue. In conversations with Bill Clinton, for example, he would talk about that. He would say, actually, you know, the Czech Republic is a part of the West, and we want this identity reinforced by Czechs. Czech Republic's membership in NATO structure, especially that at the time the prospect of Prague's acceptance into the European Union were still kind of bleak. It was not a given. So in that context, being part of NATO was seen as a stepping stone to eventual integration with Western Europe.
You were talking about NATO transforming itself out of existence. This possibility. Now, of course, there was this option discussed about Russia joining NATO. I was just wondering, could you tell us a bit about that, and maybe tell us also, what did people like Havel, like Walesa, think of that option?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I was surprised myself by looking at the record just how much the Russians wanted to join NATO. It's a theme that comes through very clearly in the early 1990s. In fact, it was Gorbachev. It started with Mikhail Gorbachev in the spring of 1990. Now, for context, this was the time when Germany was reuniting. Gorbachev agreed to United Germany being a part of NATO. He was promised that there would be no enlargement one inch to the east, as Baker told him in February 1990. Now, this was, of course, in the context of German reunification. Those remarks later became kind of controversial because the Russians say, well, you promised that there would be no enlargement, and yet you then started to push enlargement. And, of course, the counter-argument to that is that everything changed in the early 1990s, and those particular promises were given just in the context of German reunification. There was no discussion of Eastern Europe. Nevertheless, already by the spring of 1990, Gorbachev, desperate in many ways, feeling that his hope for a common European home was collapsing, that the Soviet Union itself was being effectively pushed out of Eastern Europe, made a plea to the Americans repeatedly saying, can we become part of NATO? And he was sort of laughed off. You know, this was not yet seen as a sensible argument to make. Certainly for the Bush administration, they did not want to even discuss that. The new Russian leadership, Boris Yeltsin in particular, repeatedly made this argument, and his he's called pro-Western foreign minister Andrei Kozyrev also made this argument about Russia, the importance of anchoring Russia in NATO, and this was actually done with complete seriousness. Now, why did they want to do that? I think for Russians, obviously, they did not have to worry about NATO's security guarantees. NATO served as security, or offered security guarantees against Russia, so this was not a problem for them.
What did the sort of European or Western European middle powers, such as Germany or the United Kingdom, what sort of role did they play in this new realignment of Central and Eastern Europe during this period? What were their opinions?
Well, Europeans were very cautious about West Europeans were about NATO enlargement. This idea was effectively lobbied very hard by Central and Eastern Europe, and countries like Britain and France were not so keen on this because they worried that by extending to the east, NATO would lose its credibility, among other things, that there it would acquire new territories that would be very difficult to defend, that integrating those new armies from the former Warsaw Pact would be technically extremely problematic. And what also worried them was the prospect that Russia would be against this, and that potentially by enlarging NATO, NATO would undermine reformers in Russia, allowing the Russian nationalists to claim that the whole idea of cooperating with the West was a betrayal of Russia's national interests. So this was the position in across much of Western Europe. And it was actually the Americans who were much more open to the idea of enlargement in the early Clinton administration. Already you can see from the spring of 1993, you can see movement in that direction. And by the summer, already the Americans are starting to think about, you know, in practical terms, what would that entail? Fundamentally, what Clinton was worried about is how do you enlarge NATO without upsetting Russia, because for him, Russia was the big prize, as it were. He did not want to lose Russia. He wanted to continue cooperating with Boris Yeltsin, and he knew that the Russians were against enlargement, or at least he knew that the Russians wanted to be part of that enlargement, or if enlargement ever happened, they wanted to be part of that, and they also wanted to exercise veto power, which is the Americans said, no, we will never allow you to do that. We will never allow you to say that Russia has the right to say whether Central and Eastern European countries may or may not join NATO. So in the end, the result of this debate in the Clinton administration was a program that was created to appease Russia and also to appease the Central Eastern European countries that were pushing for NATO enlargement but were not immediately were not allowed to proceed right away. And this program was called Partnership for Peace. It was rolled out at the NATO summit in January 1994. And now the Russians misunderstood Partnership for Peace. When this was presented to the Russian president Boris Yeltsin, he thought that this was an alternative to NATO enlargement. He thought, okay, so we have been protesting, or we dislike the idea of enlargement. Now you've rolled out this program, Partnership for Peace, where Russia will play an equal role. That means that enlargement is not on the cards anymore, right? The Americans were non-committal, but eventually it became very clear that enlargement was still very much on the cards, and that Russia was not in the queue to join NATO. This was just ruled out. And it was the Eastern European country, especially the Visegrad 4, that would have preference in this regard. So in this context, then, we can see from 1994 increasing Russian opposition to any kind of NATO enlargement.
If I try to summarize this, and correct me if I'm wrong, but we sort of have Central and Eastern European countries, or let's call them Central European countries, who very much want to join NATO, and they have sort of historic grudges against Russia. We have Western European powers who are very skeptical of enlarging NATO, you know, towards Russia. And then we have the Americans who are sort of considering this option of letting Russia join NATO. I was wondering, you know, what were Russia's bargaining chips, aside obviously from nuclear weapons? What could Yeltsin really say, you know, what was he able to threaten with, perhaps?
Well, what the Russians were threatening throughout this period, and I mean here particularly Russian Foreign Minister Kozyrev in his conversations with his Western counterparts, he would say, be considerate, consider Russia's position here, do not rush, because if you do, we have now forces in Russia who will come to dominate the political narrative, and people like me will be pushed out. And I am, you know, very pro-Western foreign minister. You will get somebody else who will be much less inclined to cooperate with the West. And this indeed what happened. Kozyrev was eventually forced out, and he was replaced by Evgeny Primakov, a much more hardline foreign minister. So essentially what the Russians were saying to the Americans was, if you really want Russian democracy to succeed, if you really want this cooperation between us to work out, slow down on NATO enlargement, because if you push NATO enlargement, you empower the nationalists in Russia.
One of the reasons why I wanted to talk to you is because you've been... let's say you've been sharing some quite extraordinary archival accounts of the individual leaders. You know, also, for example, maybe some Central European leaders. I mean, these were often people who came to power from, you know, from being a dissident to becoming a president or prime minister. Were there any sort of interesting episodes there when they encountered leaders of Britain, America, Germany? Do you know what I mean? From the archives, from the minutes.
Yeah. Well, you know, I can tell you, you know, when you read these records of conversations, they are sometimes hilarious, and they do give you some interesting insights into personalities and also intellectual sophistication, or sometimes the lack of intellectual sophistications on the part of those leaders. So one person who impressed me was Havel. Havel's interactions were always marked by high degree of intellectual sophistication and, if you would, vision. You know, his idealistic vision of the world. So very interesting to read. By contrast, somebody like Lech Walesa, for example, comes across as fairly unsophisticated, but also, you know, very straightforward. So in if you read his, you know, records of his discussions with the Americans, you see that they're full of gloom and doom about Russia, or, you know, the Russians are imperialists. They all think like Zhirinovsky, etc., etc. So he was definitely not particularly sophisticated in his analysis, but you can kind of understand where he was coming from. At least he made himself very clear. What is also very interesting in conversations between the Central Eastern Europeans and the Western Europe is the desire on the part of Central Eastern Europeans to be accepted as a part of the West, even as they drew the line between themselves and Russia. So, for example, when Madeleine Albright visited on an exploratory mission several of the capitals in the run-up to NATO enlargement, she found, as she put in her report, that Central and Eastern Europeans wanted to be in NATO. They wanted to be in NATO themselves, but with the Russians out. So this was very interesting for me. You know, this idea that Central and Eastern Europe wanted to assert its identity as something very different from Russia. You know, let the Russians stay where they are, there in the East, and we want to be part of Europe, as it were, which was, by the way, very different from the Russian take, because the Russians, of course, were coming to the same kind of discussions, and they were saying, we are also Europeans, we want to be a part of Europe. So there's almost a conflict of identities there, in conflict of visions between the Central and Eastern Europeans and the Russians about the future of Europe and the future of the region.
Interesting. I just also want to quickly, before we finish, ask, because this is such an interesting question, you know, the immediate years after the fall of the Iron Curtain were perhaps the single period after the Second World War, simply due to the sort of chaos or the massive change that was happening, where redrawing the map of Central and Eastern Europe could have potentially happened. I mean, I'm mentioning here, for example, this report published by Spiegel in 2010, when allegedly Kaliningrad was offered to Germany in 1990. You know, did you come across any of these sort of crazy proposals or ideas during your research?
Well, there was a lot of uncertainty, and indeed one of the arguments for NATO enlargement, as made by the Americans, by people like Tony Lake, who was Clinton's national security advisor, is to prevent this sort of scenario, because there were serious worries, and those worries were justified. Just look at what was happening in Yugoslavia at that time. We have an absolute meltdown in the Balkans, ethnic cleansing, redrawing of borders, you know, creation of wannabe Greater Serbia, etc. Just really, really crazy things are happening on the ground. And the fear in Washington was that potentially this sort of, you know, Yugoslav nationalistic contention could also spread to other parts of Central and Eastern Europe. Now, fortunately, that did not happen. But NATO enlargement was in part an effort to make sure that it does not happen.
You have previously been focused a lot on China and the Cold War. Why did you choose to research this period now? I mean, are you preparing a book or an article?
Yes, so I have a big book on the Cold War and indeed, as I call it, the Cold War and after. Cold War historians generally stop in 1989, and the fall of the Berlin Wall scene is seen here as a kind of cutoff date between the Cold War world and the Brave New World that we entered in 1989. And from the perspective of Central and Eastern Europe, and indeed from the German perspective, for example, 1989 does make a lot of sense as a cutoff point. However, from Russia's perspective, it's not the same. It's not as straightforward. And indeed, as we move into the 1990s, we see the same sort of concerns that animated Soviet foreign policy making about Soviet standing in the world, about whether the Soviet voice is listened to in international affairs, also animate Russian policy making. So I see a lot of continuity between the Cold War and the post-Cold War. So in this book that starts in 1949, I look at the history of the Cold War, primarily told from the Soviet perspective. I look at how it unfolded in Asia, in Europe, and I continue the discussion all the way into the 1990s, and indeed all the way to the present day, seeing considerable continuity across the entire period.
And this book is called, or will be called?
Well, that's a big question. The book, which already has 25 chapters and is very nearly to being finished, still has no name, because you wonder what to call it. My provisional title is The First Fiddle, A History of the Cold War and After. Why do I say The First Fiddle? This actually comes from something that Nikita Khrushchev said in his time about Sino-Soviet relations. He was discussing the ideological conflict between the Soviet Union and China, which unfolded in the 1960s. And he said, you know, they say we have an ideological conflict with China, but that's just not true. This is not what it's about. It's actually about China wanted to be number one, but they cannot do that. So they want to play the first fiddle, but we are the first fiddle in the socialist orchestra. So for me, that emphasized Soviet concern about their role in the world, about their place in the world, about their desire to play the first fiddle. And this is a concern that you can see run throughout Soviet and indeed Russian foreign policy and continues to the present day.
During your research, what do you think sort of is the most curious thing you learned, or something which you perhaps didn't expect coming into this?
One thing that I find absolutely remarkable is, as documents are declassified, then you have actually an opportunity to psychoanalyze discourses and actually look from almost a psychologist or even the psychiatrist perspective into policy making by different parties during the Cold War and after. So when you look at these conversations by, let's say, involving Yeltsin or American leaders or Khrushchev or Brezhnev, what you see is what kind of people they were and what really animated, what really drove them. And the number one thing that I see there is not ideology. It's not ideology. Ideology for them was always something instrumental. You justify things with reference to ideology. For the Soviets, it was Marxism-Leninism. Yeah, did Brezhnev really believe in Marxism-Leninism? Well, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. Fundamentally, when he made policy, it wasn't Marxism-Leninism that drove that policy. It was concern with his own political legitimacy. And it was true for Brezhnev, it was true for Khrushchev, it was true for Stalin, it was true for, Gorbachev and Yeltsin. It's even true for Putin, I think, today. So this emphasis on political legitimacy and how leaders justify themselves and how they justify their policy is what I find the most interesting in this project.
And you were just listening there to Professor of International Relations at Cardiff University, Sergei Radchenko, who was speaking there about the realignment in Eastern Europe after the fall of the Iron Curtain in 1989. This interview was first broadcast on the 27th of June 2020. My name is Tom McEncrow, and I wish you a very nice weekend.